Let's pick up what we left off in the book of Judges. And Lord willing, tonight we're going to try to finish this book up. And we left off in chapter 19, right? That's what we're going to pick up tonight. And it's an episode in Israel's history that it covers these next three chapters. We're going to have to try to read these three chapters together because, like I said, you can't really break it up. But this is an episode in Israel's history where I think a lot of people just kind of skim over this story, what unfolds here, because it gets really pretty gruesome. But I can't help when I read this. I see tremendous spiritual application, and I see so much, I think, relevance for us today if we go through this, because I think it's given to us as a dark warning. But anyway, let's just read the first chapter, and then I'll explain where I'm coming from. It says in verse 1, it says, in chapter 19, it says, "Now it came about in those days that there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in a remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judea. But his concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for a period of 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. And his father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and they drank, and they lodged there. Now it came about on the fourth day that they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go. And the girl's father said to the son-in-law, 'Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterwards you may go.' So both of them sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, 'Please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry.' Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. And on the fifth day he arose to go early in the morning, and the girl's father said, 'Please sustain yourself and wait until afternoon.' So both of them ate. And when the man arose to go along with his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, 'Behold, now the days are drawn to a close. Please spend the night.' Says, 'Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here, that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow you may arise early for your journey, so that you may go home.' But the man was not willing to spend the night, so he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. And there were with him a pair of saddled donkeys. His concubine also was with him. And when they were near Jebus, the day was almost gone, and the servant said to his master, 'Please come and let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it.' However, his master said to him, 'We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel, but we will go as far as Gibeah.' And he said to his servant, 'Come and let us approach one of these places, and we will spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah.' So they passed along and went their way, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there in order to enter the lodging in Gibeah. And when they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. Then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjaminites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, 'Where are you going, and where do you come from?' And he said to them, 'We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there, and I went to Bethlehem in Judah. But I am now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. Yet there is both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and your young man who is with your servants. There is no lack of anything.' And the old man said, 'Peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend a night in the open square.' So he took him into his house and gave the donkey fodder, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. And while they were making merry, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding on the door. And they spoke to the owner of the house of the old man, saying, 'Bring out the man who came into your house, so that we may have relations with him.' Then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said, 'No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of folly. Here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish, but do not commit such an act of folly against the man. But the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them, and they raped her and abused her all night until morning, and then they let her go at the approach of dawn. And as the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. And when her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, then behold, his concubine was laying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, "Get up and let us go." But there was no answer. Then he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine and cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. And it came about that all those who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the days when our sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider, take counsel, and speak up." Now, you know, obviously the reason why I read this whole 30 verses of this chapter 19 is because you can't break it up. But like I said, you read this, and obviously, I mean, I think it really turns a lot of people off of what had happened here. But I think there's so much in this in terms of its spiritual significance for us today, because it says a lot. First of all, you know, I'm going to jump ahead of myself a little bit here, but we find out in the next couple of chapters that this is during the days of Phinehas. This is the grandson of Aaron. So this apparently took place not too long after the Israelites got into their land and secured their territory. And so what that suggests to me, like when we were talking last week, how it's so easy to fall into apostasy. It's so easy. In other words, apostasy is a falling away. And I read from you from the 2 Thessalonians last week about how Paul says that the Antichrist will not come to power until the apostasy takes place first. In other words, there'll be a general falling away. However, at the same time, people will be laying claim to believe in God, and they'll lay claim to a form of godliness, but deny the power therein. In other words, they'll claim to be spiritual. They'll claim to believe in God. But the God that they believe in, obviously, it boils down to another Christ, another gospel, another spirit. You know, it's not the God of the Bible. Well, here's a situation where when you have apostasy, when there's a falling away, apostasy comes first, and then what do you see? Then you begin to see perversion. Then you begin to see moral corruption. Then you begin to see all kinds of depravity beginning to manifest itself. And look at the society we're living in today. I mean, did you see the last Sunday's Sacramento Bee? I got a copy of it in my car, but right above the fold, they have the these two homosexuals raising a family. You read the article, and what this whole paper was trying to do is project onto society that this is a good thing, all right? That this alternate lifestyle is a good thing, and that there's no difference between homosexual couples raising a family and that of a heterosexual. And as a matter of fact, this is Tuesday's USA Today. I don't know if you guys read an article in here, but they're saying that more and more they're having what they call surrogate mothers that are being implanted with sperm donors and eggs to carry to term, you know, children for homosexuals. Well, this is a society that we live in. And what's really trying to be portrayed here is that this lifestyle is good, that it's healthy, that it's acceptable. But one thing they do not show you, all right, is that if you do have a homosexual family that's intact, it is really a rarity. In other words, what's really transpiring is that the overwhelming majority of people who get into a homosexual lifestyle, especially men, it becomes a form of addiction where it sinks deeper and deeper into depravity. This is something that the paper, that the media, that the press, that the Hollywood, that the cultural elite will never, ever tell you. So what happens here is that when there's an apostasy, then, you know, once you have that falling away, believe me, you've created a vacuum, and Satan's just going to immediately get in there with his own corrupting influences upon mankind. And now you see this and you read this, and the thing that really, I think, strikes me about this is how early this happened in their history. Because, like I said, and you read in 19 and 20, you see that Phinehas is still alive. All right, and he's probably very, very old at this particular time, but, you know, he's the grandson of Aaron. So we're only talking one or two generations removed from Moses that this particular situation took place. Now, I'm going to see who's thinking here, because I think you got to look at this and you got to put it all together, because to me, it really speaks volumes. Now, here's a guy. He's got a concubine. It's one of his wives. He lives up here in the hill country of Ephraim, which is up in here, all right? And then she runs away from him. Some Bible say she played the harlot. So anyway, whatever it is, she got ticked off at him, went down here, back down to Bethlehem to, you know, to her father's house. 4 months later, he goes down to Bethlehem, you know, speaks kindly to her and wants to bring her back home. And the father-in-law is just really ecstatic about seeing him. So he stays there a few days, and the father-in-law keeps delaying him and wants him to stay longer and stay longer. And then finally, I think it's on the fifth day, he says, man, I got to get out of here. And he gets a late start. He leaves late in the afternoon, and he goes from Bethlehem. You can see it on his map here. He goes to Bethlehem, and here's Jerusalem here. It's in the Bible's Jebus. Okay, this is before David came along and conquered Jerusalem. But anyway, long story short, he decides he's not going to stay there. He's going to go up to Gibeah. And that's where he figures, well, I'll go with where my own people are at, because, you know, you can't trust these Canaanites. Well, here's the thing, all right? He travels probably about 12 miles or so from Bethlehem to get to Gibeah. And he gets to Gibeah, and nobody there will take him in. And, of course, it was a pretty much of a custom in those days that people were to be hospitable to travelers. Well, in this particular city, this is the city of Israel. These are the city of the Benjaminites. Nobody's taking him in. And then an old man comes in from the, I guess, farming. And he's from the hill country of Ephraim. I don't know if he's basically a hired hand that's just staying in Gibeah. But he sees him in the square, and he's alarmed. He says, what are you guys doing here in the square? Because he knows this is a dangerous place to be. This city is dangerous, all right? It's almost like, look at our cities today. Nobody in their right mind would camp out in a city or even try to sleep in your car in some of our cities, especially like Washington, D.C. or New York or L.A. or San Francisco, these type of places, because this is the culture we live in today. Where people, you know, they're going to rob you, they're going to mug you, they're going to rape you, they're going to, you know, do you harm. This guy saw the danger there and said, well, come home with me. He gets home, he's showing all this hospitality to his guests, and then the men of the city surround his house, they start pounding on the door, says, bring the man out, we want to know him sexually. Now, what does that remind you of?
Two angels come in and
not taking him. Because it's making it look like anyone that isn't totally heterosexual is a bad person, because this is the only place, if I remember right, in the Bible that I remember this coming up about, you know, gay people. But I know a couple wonderful people that their hormones are messed up and they don't practice it, but they feel that way.
Okay, let me just make this abundantly clear, okay? All right, homosexuality is a sin. But so is adultery, and so is fornication. I'm not picking on homosexuals. The reason I even brought up this incident about this big, huge article in the Sacramento Bee on Sunday and this other article here in the USA Today, okay, is because today our society is promoting this lifestyle. It's promoting it. It's saying this is good. Anybody that opposes it is bad. All right, and I'm trying to get people to see, hey, you got to use some discernment here. Mm-hmm. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that probably some homosexual people are the nicest people you'd ever want to meet on the face of the earth, okay? But God has forbidden this lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And so you got to call an ace and a spade. This is sin. Now, I know that what they're trying to indoctrinate us with is that, hey, man, God made me this way. It's in my genes. It's in my makeup. But we got to understand something like this. We're all born with a fallen nature, every single one of us. And every single one of us has a predisposition towards certain sins. That's all there is to it. But here's the thing. God knows that, and he just came out and told us very plainly, you know, this is sin. And this is good, this is right, and this is wrong, this is true, this is false. We can't fall into the trap of our society and say, hey man, you know, if you condemn homosexuality as a lifestyle, then therefore you're being bigoted, or you're being intolerant, or you're being hateful, or you're being homophobic, or anything like that. You're just going by what God has said, all right? That's what you got to understand. This isn't a attack homosexual night at all. It's just, hey, are we going to be honest enough to look at this and say, you know what? This is what God says about this behavior. And then be honest enough to just stand up and say, okay, this is wrong. Because today in our society, to stand up and say that this is wrong, you are going to be labeled as being hateful and intolerant and bigoted and homophobic. You are. Because our society not only wants to tolerate this, they are doing everything in their power to promote this. All right? I didn't want to get off on a tangent here, but keep that in mind, okay? That, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're homosexual or you're an adulterer or you're a fornicator. You need to repent of your sin. That's the bottom line. But what I'm driving at is that this particular lifestyle, when you get involved in this, it really can become more and more of a type of perversion and a type of depravity, all right? Because what you've done is you've given yourself over to this. And then we're told in Romans that people who do this, God gives them over to a depraved mind. Well, this is what we see in these guys. But what the important thing is, when you're reading this story, you see what happens to this guy. Now, this guy, when I read this, now I realize that we're, you know, probably 3,000 years removed, 3,500 years removed from this particular situation, this particular episode. But I think that, you know, you look at it and you read, well, what kind of man is this that would throw his wife out, you know, to these animals?
Yeah.
You would think
that she's going to be raped.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, when we read on,
the guy was going to give his dog. I don't understand.
That's why I'm just saying this in passing. All right. It appears that, of course, at that particular time, what was the custom of the time and the belief of the time was that women were property. That was it. All right? Now, Jesus came along and set the whole record straight. He elevated womanhood up like no one ever did. And Paul says in Christ Jesus is neither male nor female, or slave or free, or Greek or Jew, this type of thing. All right? That we're all on an equal footing. But, of course, this was just the time and day that they lived in. All right? When women were considered to be more as property. So here's the thing. I would think to myself, if the guy really loved his wife, he wouldn't be so concerned about saving his own hiney, and he would have done something to protect her. But he throws her out to protect himself. But that's not what's important here as far as this episode is concerned. What's important is that he goes, he gets up, and you see this guy. He seems to me to be really cold, indifferent, callous, whatever. All right? But he gets up, sees his wife there, laying at the threshold of the doorway. He thinks she's just asleep. He says, get up, we're going to get going, and she's dead. So he puts her on her donkey, takes her back to his hometown, and then he cuts her up into 12 pieces and sends each of that mutilated part of her body, each separate mutilated part, to a different tribe in Israel. With messengers, he sent them there and said, this is what the men of Gibeah are responsible for. And that motivated people to get down there and to find out what was going on and to deal with this. Now, but you got to think this thing through now. Why do you think this guy cut up his concubine? Why couldn't he just send messengers out there and explain the situation? Why do you think he did that?
Get their attention.
Yeah.
Well,
so far gone, it would take something dramatic like that to...
Yeah, you got it right. You hit it right on it. In other words, bring it up to where we live and breathe, all right? Here's the thing. Look at what we do, what we've done to almost 50 million. The number keeps rising. It's almost 50 million children that we have murdered in the womb, all right? You know what the media will never do? It will never, ever do this. It will never show you an abortion. It will never show you a partial birth abortion. It will never show you that on TV. It will never show you that in a magazine. It will never bring that to your attention. It won't. Because they know in their heart of hearts that it is so gruesome, and it is so depraved, and it is so inhumane, that they know it's going to offend people's sensibilities, and they're going to be convicted to do something about it. So what I'm driving at is this. Their culture, their society, had so disintegrated morally, that this man knew in his heart of hearts, I've got to do something to really shock these people out of their complacency and out of their indifference and out of their apathy and out of their self-righteousness. And that's exactly what he did. He dismembered his wife and sent a part of his wife to each of the tribes of Israel. And that motivated people to say, hey, we better do something about this, because if we don't, God's going to bring judgment upon us all. Does that make sense to you guys? Do you see where I'm coming from? All right. I think most people, I know when I was a new Christian, I first read this, I couldn't get it through my head. I said, why would he do that? Why would he do that? And of course, the more you think about it, the more you reflect upon it, the more you view it, you see, I know why he did it. He did it because there was no other way in which he could motivate people to do the right thing. Now, I think this guy ought to have his head examined personally. All right. But you see where he was driven to this point of desperation because the society around him, if he went and told them of these men of Gibeah and their depravity and what they were doing, what do you think, you know, the nation of Israel would have done? They would have yawned and went back to sleep. They would have. There's no doubt in my mind. All right? So he just knew that he had to do something really, really extreme to get these people's attention. I mean, that says a lot to me anyway, because what it would it take for us to be shocked out of our complacency when it comes to murdering the unborn? Personally, I don't think anything is going to shake us out of our complacency at this point in time. But I do think this, if everyone was forced to watch what really happens in abortion, all right, I think it would make a big difference. But people want to close their eyes, they want to blind their eyes, they don't want to see it, and the media is not about to show it to you. But look how selective they are. If, when they want to incite people, they can do it, can't they? By showing something over and over and over again until they get a city burning or a riot started. Well, now look at how this unfolds, because I really think it's instructive, because it says here in that verse 1 in chapter 20, it says, "Then all the sons of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, came out, and the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. And the chiefs of all the people, even of all the tribes of Israel, took their stand in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword." Now, I know almost all Bibles say 400,000 foot soldiers, and for some reason the Living Bible says 450,000. I think that they were probably including the people in logistics. I don't know. Does your Bible, anybody's Bible say 450,000? Because I think almost all Bibles say 400,000 men who drew the sword. And in verse 3 it says, "Now the sons of Benjamin heard that the sons of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. And the sons of Israel said, 'Tell us, how did this wickedness take place?' So the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, 'I came with my concubine to spend the night in Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. But the men of Gibeah rose up against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me. Instead, they ravaged my concubine, so she died. And I took hold of my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout the land of Israel's inheritance, for they have committed a lewd and disgraceful act in Israel. Behold, all you sons of Israel, give your advice and counsel here.' And all the people arose as one man, saying, 'Not one of us will go to his tent, nor will any of us return to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot, and we will take 10 men out of 100 throughout the tribes of Israel, and 100 out of 1,000, and 1,000 out of 10,000 to supply food for the people, that when they come to Gibeah of Benjamin, they may punish them for all the disgraceful acts that they have committed in Israel. Thus all the men of Israel were gathered against the city, united as one man." Now, see, you read this, and to me it's pretty obvious. This is the only way that they were going to be united as one man, you know, to oppose this evil, is that he had to shock them into it. Verse 12 says, "Then the tribes of Israel sent men throughout the entire tribe of Benjamin, saying, 'What is this wickedness that has taken place among you? Now then, deliver them up, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove this wickedness from Israel.' But the sons of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the sons of Israel. And the sons of Benjamin gathered from the cities to Gibeah to go out to battle against the sons of Israel. And from the cities on that day, the sons of Benjamin were numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who were numbered 700 choice men. And out of all these people, 700 choice men were left-handed. Each one of them could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. Then the men of Israel, besides Benjamin, were numbered 400,000 men who draw the sword, and all these were men of war." Now, just get this picture here. Look at that verse 13. This is what they did. They first sent a delegation to Gibeah. And what did he ask him? He says, "Now then, deliver up the men, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove this wickedness from Israel." First, they make an appeal. They get an army together, 400,000 men, and they're going to go up against Gibeah. And they, first of all, send a delegation over there and says, "Give up these worthless men, and then we're going to execute them to rid our land of this evil, of this wickedness." And they wouldn't give them up. So now what's going to unfold here is it's a tremendous judgment that's going to unfold. But here's the thing. They had gotten to that point in Israel's history where things had become so lax morally, and so I think their moral compass was just thrown out the window, where people were actually protecting these men. They were protecting them rather than giving them up. And look what's happening today as far as his lifestyle is concerned. It is being protected by law, and it is being promoted by law. And God help you if you stand up to oppose it, because you are going to be called everything in the book. Well, that's exactly what happened in Benjamin. It's exactly what happened to the people of Benjamin, is that they would not give up these people, but rather they were going to protect them at all costs. And like I've said 1,000,000,000 times, you know, it really doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to me personally. But here's the point, all right? It's what God has said. That's what's all important. You know, so people have got to get their blinders off and recognize, hey, when a Christian stands up and says, you know, this lifestyle is an affront to God, it's not their opinion. It's not my opinion, because I really could care less. It's just that what God has said, and therefore I feel that we are morally obligated to stand up for what he has said. I mean, when we try to be all things to all people, believe me, you've got nothing. And the Bible says very plainly that the fear of man is a snare, that what we really need to do is fear God. And Jesus was talked about, hey, that we are the salt of the earth, we are the leaven for society, that we are the light of the world. And he said, hey, man, if the salt loses its flavor, what good is it? It's of no use at all but to be thrown out in the manure pile or to fill up potholes. That's basically what he said. And let's face it, you can't be the salt of the earth without smarting somebody. Because believe me, if you stand up and say, you know what, homosexuality is a sin and abortion is murder, you're going to smart somebody. You're going to offend somebody. You're going to tick somebody off. But look at Jesus Christ. People have this really distorted view of him when they feel like he was just the epitome of tolerance, because they always try to project him as being, you know, compassionate and loving and merciful and all these other things. But believe me, if he was so tolerant, why did they crucify him? Why did they railroad him to his death? When you really, honestly, and truthfully study the Gospels and read about Jesus Christ, you will find that he was one of the most intolerant people that ever walked the face of the earth. So when you read this kind of thing, what do you see happening here? I think it's happening in our own nation. It's happening right underneath our noses, and it's happening all around the world. And when you read this in verse 13, now then, deliver up the men, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove this wickedness from Israel. But the sons of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the sons of Israel. Okay? They just weren't about to do it. And we're not about to give up our sin either. What did Jesus say in John chapter 3? He said, people prefer darkness rather than light. Why?
Because
their deeds are evil. And that's exactly where Benjamin had gotten, all right? So what happens is, here's that verse 14, the sons of Benjamin gathered from the cities to Gibeah to go out to battle against the sons of Israel. And from the cities on that day, the sons of Benjamin would number 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah who were numbered 700 choice men. So what it's saying here, you see this on this map here, you see Benjamin. It's saying all these surrounding cities, the men from these surrounding cities in Benjamin all congregated together and went to Gibeah. And Gibeah had 700 fighting men in that city. And that city is the one that was responsible. So all these cities, all these men from these different cities are going to Gibeah to defend these men, to defend these wicked men. Now, what unfolds here, I think, is really insightful, because it says here in their verse, look at verse 16. It says, now that these men, 700 choice men, were left-handed, each one could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. In other words, even though the Benjaminites were way outnumbered, they were far more effective as far as their military ability was concerned. And it says here in that verse 17, then the men of Israel, besides Benjamin, were numbered 400,000 men who drew the sword, and all these were men of war. Now the sons of Israel rose and went to Bethel and inquired of God and said, who shall go up for us to the battle against the sons of Benjamin? Then the Lord said, Judah shall go up first. So the sons of Israel rose in the morning and camped at Gibeah. And the sons of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin, and the men of Israel arrayed for battle against them at Gibeah. And the sons of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and fell to the ground on that day, 22,000 men of Israel. But the men of Israel encouraged themselves and arrayed for battle again in the place where they had arrayed themselves the first day. And the sons of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until evening and inquired of the Lord, saying, shall we again draw near for battle against the sons of my brother? Benjamin. And the Lord says, go up against him. Then the sons of Israel came against the sons of Benjamin the second day. And Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah the second day and fell to the ground 18,000 men of the sons of Israel. All these drew the sword. And then all the sons of Israel and all the people went up and came to Bethel and wept. Thus they remained there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening. And they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, Aaron's son, stood before it to minister in those days, saying, shall I yet again go out to battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hands. So you see what's happening here? The first day they go out, and they get the snot kicked out of them. 22,000 men die. Okay, of Israel. I mean, Benjamin is just, they're far outnumbered, but they're far more superior as far as their military ability is concerned. And so they kill 22,000 of them, and then Israel starts weeping, and they go before the Lord and say, hey man, we make a mistake here? Are we supposed to go up against these guys again? He says, yeah, go up against them again. Then the next day, they lose 18,000 men. And now they really go before the Lord weeping, and now they're fasting, and now they're praying, and now they're offering sacrifices, saying, hey man, did we read you right? Are we supposed to go up against these people or not? Or should we just give this thing up? And God says, go up, because tomorrow I'm going to give them into your hands. Now you tell me, why do you think they lost 22,000 men the first day and 18,000 men the second day, and now they're going to go into battle a third day? Why would they incur such a loss, all right, at the hands of wicked people?
God was testing their faith?
I think it goes much further than that. Why do you think?
This man to cut up this
right concubine. You got it. In other words, hey, God is judging the whole nation because they have allowed things to deteriorate to that point where this guy had to take such drastic measures to get them motivated. You know what? I mean, look at our country. I mean, you know, people are just probably getting sick of hearing me, but I'm telling you, I just got to keep pounding home the point. What do you think it would take? What do you think it would take to turn this country around morally to the point where we would give up murdering unborn children? We're not going to do it. We're not going to give up this sin. We love our sin, and we're not going to give it up. And so this nation as a whole is going to be judged severely. All right? Even though we do have some people, they're the minority, that are fighting tooth and nail to try to defend unborn children. But still, as a whole, as a nation, we're going to get chastised. We're going to be judged severely. There's no doubt in my mind about it, and I believe it's coming in the very near future. We all feel it in our bones. We all feel it in our gut. It's coming, isn't it? We just sense it. It's coming. We're going to have 9/11 times, 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000. It's coming because of our wickedness. You see, that's why God did this. In other words, the whole nation is now coming under judgment because the nation itself is responsible for this kind of wickedness that they allowed to get out of hand. They should have nipped it in the bud in its early stages, but people were apathetic and they were indifferent. And this was the end result. All right? So anyway, back at that verse 28, it says, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, Aaron's son, stood before to minister in those days, saying, shall I yet again go out to battle against the sons of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver him into your hand. So Israel set men in ambush around Gibeah, and the sons of Israel went up against the sons of Benjamin on the third day and arrayed themselves against Gibeah as at other times. And verse 31 says, and the sons of Benjamin went out against the people who were drawn away from the city, and they began to strike and kill some of the people, as at other times, on the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah, and in the field about 30 men of Israel. And the sons of Benjamin said, they are struck down before us as at first. But the sons of Israel said, let us flee that we may draw them away from the city to the highways. Then all the men of Israel rose from their place, and they arrayed themselves at the Baal Tamar, and the men of Israel in ambush broke out of their place, even at Mare Gibba. When 10,000 choice men from all of Israel came at Gibeah, the battle became fierce, but Benjamin did not know that the disaster was close to them. Now, look at that verse here, in that last sentence in that verse 34. All right, now the judgment is coming upon them, but look at this. But Benjamin did not know that the disaster was close to them. You know, And I don't think that we realize that disaster is just right on our heels as a nation. And verse 35, and the Lord struck Benjamin before Israel so that the sons of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day, all who drew the sword. So the sons of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. And when the men of Israel gave ground to Benjamin because they relied on the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah, the men in ambush hurried and rushed against Gibeah, and the men in ambush also deployed and struck all the city with the edge of the sword. Now the appointed sign between the men of Israel and the men in ambush was that they should make a great cloud of smoke arise from the city. Then the men of Israel turned in battle, and Benjamin began to strike and kill about 30 men of Israel, for they said, surely they are defeated before us as in the first battle. But when the cloud began to rise from the city in a column of smoke, Benjamin looked behind them, and behold, the whole city was going up into smoke in heaven. You know, don't let this go over your head. It's talking about columns of smoke and the whole city going up in smoke in heaven, to heaven. Believe me, that's going to happen. And it's going to happen to our country. It's going to happen to our nation. It's going to happen to our world. He says in verse 41, then the men of Israel turned, and the men of Benjamin were terrified, for they saw the disaster was close to them. Therefore, they turned their backs before the men of Israel towards the direction of the wilderness, but the battle overtook them while those who came out of the cities destroyed them in the midst of them. And they surrounded Benjamin, pursued them without rest, and trod them down opposite Gibeah towards the east. Thus 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. All these were valiant warriors. The rest turned and fled towards the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon. But they caught 5,000 of them on the highways and overtook them at Gidom and killed 2,000 of them. So all of Benjamin who fell that day were 25,000 men who drew the sword, and all were valiant warriors. But 600 men turned and fled towards the wilderness of the rock of Rimmon, and they remained at the rock of Rimmon 4 months. Now, you see what happened here? Once God judged the nation, all right, he turned around and judged Benjamin. And you see this pattern all the time through Scripture. I mean, like Peter says, judgment begins in the house of the Lord. Well, you know, God's going to judge his own people first, and then he's going to judge the wicked. So he judged his own people, and then he turned around, and, you know, Benjamin is really, really chastised. I mean, and he is literally beat within an inch of his life. Because as a tribe, as a nation, they're virtually almost wiped out. Because it says, we pick up in that verse 47, but 600 men turned and fled towards the wilderness of the rock of Rimmon, and they remained at the rock of Rimmon for 4 months. Then the men of Israel turned back against the sons of Benjamin and struck them with the edge of the sword, both the entire city with the cattle and all they found, and they also set on fire the cities which they found. In other words, once they defeated the army, and then 600 men fled to the wilderness, the armies of Israel went back to all these different cities in Benjamin, and they killed every man, woman, and child, and dog, and donkey, and everything else, and they set their cities on fire. Look at the tremendous judgment that came against them. Because, you know, if they had any wisdom, if they had any common sense, if they had any fear of God, they would have delivered up these sinners and saved themselves a tremendous judgment. But now, look at them. They're almost completely wiped out to a man. Let's just finish up this book, to finish up this chapter. Now, this is chapter 21. We'll just finish it up. It says, now the men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah, saying, none of us shall give his daughters to Benjamin in marriage. So the people came to Bethel and sat there before God until evening, and lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And they said, why, O Lord God of Israel, has this come about in Israel so that one tribe should be missing today in Israel? And it came about that the next day the people arose early and built an altar there and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And the sons of Israel said, who is there among all the tribes of Israel who did not come up in the assembly of the Lord? For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord at Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. And the sons of Israel were sorry for their brother Benjamin, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord not to give them any of our daughters in marriage? And they said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel who did not come up to the Lord at Mizpah? And behold, no one came up to the camp from Gabesh Gilead to the assembly. For when the people were numbered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Gabesh Gilead came there. And the congregation sent 12,000 valiant warriors there and commanded them, saying, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead with the edge of the sword and with the women and the little ones. And this is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every man and every woman who has lain with a man. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him. And they brought them to the camp of Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. Then the whole congregation sent word and spoke to the sons of Benjamin who were at the Rock of Rimmon and proclaimed peace to them. And Benjamin returned at that time, and they gave them the women who they had kept alive from the women of Jabesh Gilead, yet they were not enough for them. And the people were sorry for Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. Now, before we wind this down, here's another interesting thing. When all of these armies, or all these men from Israel, all over Israel, had gone down to Mizpah, that's where their base of operation began for this conflict, they all swore before God that because of this wickedness, none of us are going to give our daughters to the sons of Benjamin to be wives. So now they almost wipe out the entire tribe. There's only 600 men left. And now all of Israel just feel terrible about that because they feel like, man, you know, we're going to be missing a whole tribe. It's like losing a family member. And they feel like, well, we already swore before God we can't give them our daughters to them. So what they did is they took inventory and said, well, who didn't come up to fight with us? And they found out that the men of Jabesh Gilead did not go up to fight against Benjamin. And so they sent an army of 12,000 men there, and they destroyed the city. They destroyed every man, woman, and child in the city except for 400 virgins who they basically captured and brought back, and they were going to give them to the men of Benjamin so that the tribe would not be wiped out. But they're still 200 women short. But here's the thing. What does that tell you? What does this tell you spiritually about the judgment on Jabesh Gilead? What does it tell you?
No sitting on the fence.
There it is. In other words, hey, how many times have you heard the old adage? The only thing needed for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. Right? We're in the midst of this conflict, this spiritual battle that is just absolutely intense. It's absolutely intense. And you take a look at just the last election we had, just a few months back. All right? How many quote-unquote church members stayed home and didn't do a thing when it came to going to the polls to vote? Now, granted, I went to the polls to vote, and I'll be honest with you, I held my nose and I voted, all right? Because I couldn't stand the people I was voting for, but I felt like, hey, I have to vote for these people because to vote for the other party means that, you know, you're going to have blood on your hands because this other party promotes the destruction of these innocent children. You see, so if you're just going to sit home and do nothing, believe me, you're going to bring a judgment on yourself. You know, there is no sitting on the fence in this spiritual warfare. Jesus himself said, hey, I know your deeds. You're neither hot nor cold. I would that you were hot or cold, but since you're lukewarm, I'm going to vomit you out of my mouth. God finds lukewarm, apathetic, indifferent people to be nauseating. He wants us freezing cold or boiling hot. You know, he doesn't want us lukewarm. He doesn't want us just inoculated with enough religion or spirituality to make us feel comfortable in our sins. He wants us to get in the throes of this battle and to be for him. Because he said, if you're not gathering with me, this is what Jesus said, if you don't gather with me, you're scattering against me. Jesus basically said, either you're for me or against me. And people say, well, I'm not against Jesus, but let me ask you something. Are you gathering with him? Are you gathering for him? Are you working for him? You see what I'm saying? That's what he's looking for. Well, these men of Jabesh Gilead, they couldn't be bothered. They were apathetic. They were lukewarm. They were indifferent. They probably yawned. They probably said, hey, we're not getting involved with that. Besides that, Benjamin, these people are our friends, and we're not going to get involved with it. And look what happened to them. Their whole city gets wiped out. That was from God. It really was. It was a judgment upon them. You know, I think that's pretty darn instructive to us. Pick up with verse 15. And the people were sorry for Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. Verse 16. Then the elders of the congregation said, what shall we do for the wives of those who are left, since the women are destroyed out of Benjamin? And they said, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that the tribe may not be blotted out from Israel. But we cannot give them wives of our daughters, for the sons of Israel have sworn, saying, cursed is he who gives a wife to Benjamin. So they said, behold, there is a feast of the Lord from year to year in Shiloh, which is on the north side of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem, and on the south side of Lebanon, of Libona, rather. And verse 20 says, and they commanded the sons of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in wait in the vineyards, and watch and behold, if the daughters of Shiloh come out to take part in the dances, then you shall come out of the vineyards, and each of you shall catch his wife from the daughters of Shiloh, and go to the land of Benjamin. And it shall come about that when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, that we shall say to them, give them to us voluntarily, because we did not take for each man of Benjamin a wife in battle, nor did you give them to them, else you would now be guilty. And the sons of Benjamin did so, and took wives according to their number from those who had danced, whom they carried away. And they went and returned to their inheritance, and rebuilt the cities, and lived in them. And the sons of Israel departed from there at that time, and every man to his tribe and family, and each one of them went out from there to his inheritance. In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, did you get what was taking place here? They were 200 brides short for the 600 men that were left. And they didn't know how they were going to be able to provide these men with wives so that they could perpetuate this tribe without violating the oath that they swore before God. So what they did is say, okay, well, listen, every year they have this festival that goes on at Shiloh. And during this festival, they have a lot of women that are out there, and they're dancing in this celebration. And what they told the sons of Benjamin to do is, hey, you guys, lie in wait. And when the women come out to dance, just run out there and grab yourself a wife and run away with her. And then when their family comes and complains to us, then we will explain the situation and just say, let it be, let it go, because otherwise this tribe is going to be wiped out. So you see how they were able to technically keep their word? They didn't give their daughters to the remaining sons of Benjamin. They didn't give them to them. The sons of Benjamin stole them. You see, so technically they got around this. I guess there must have been some lawyers in the group or something. You know, there was a loophole there. So in other words, this is the only way that they could, you know, justify being able to get these men wives so they could perpetuate their tribe. All right? But you see how this unfolds here? I think it's very, very instructive. Like I said, these last three chapters in the book of Judges, I think most Christians just skip over because it's pretty hard to, I think, reconcile what was happening there with our Christian faith today and how we live today. But when I read this, it all just jumps out at me because I see what God is trying to tell us here. Remember in Galatians chapter 3, it says, hey, this is given to us as our tutor. It's given to us as our instructor. It's our teacher. And you got to ask, what's it trying to teach us? Because I really believe this is very, very instructive to us today. Because believe me, we're no different than Benjamin was centuries ago. We're no different. What are we doing today? We will fight to the death to protect, quote unquote, the rights of homosexuals to do their thing, to marry, to do whatever. And like I said, I'm not attacking homosexuals. I'm just telling you what God has said. And if we don't take a stand against this evil, then it's going to degenerate into more and more depravity. And this is where we're at today. Our country is so totally apathetic and indifferent to this evil that, you know, God is going to bring tremendous judgment upon all of us because of it. I think it's a dark warning to all of us. And of course, the last verse here says, in those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. How many times have we read that through this entire book of Judges? We've read it over and over and over again. And, you know, the suggestion to me is pretty strong that we do need strong spiritual leadership today. We really do. And we don't see a lot of it. We just don't. There's so much spiritual compromises going on all over the turf. And a lot of our churches have capitulated to the point where they are promoting this lifestyle. You've got the Episcopalian Church and a number of other churches that are marrying homosexuals. And they're having homosexual bishops and homosexual preachers and stuff like that. And I'm just simply saying, hey, man, I'm not a homophobe, and I'm not filled with hate towards these people. I know in my heart of hearts, except for the grace of God, there goes me. But we have to, I really believe we have to, as Christians, stand up and say, you know what, this is what God has said. And to negate what he has said it's just going to bring judgment upon ourselves. You tell me, what do you think it's going to take, you know, to turn this situation around? What do you think it would take for us to give up our abortions? At this point in time, I think even if the media were to show everybody in this country an abortion, we wouldn't change our mind. Because we're so far gone now that even that shock value is not going to motivate us to do the right thing. You know? I mean, at least this Levite who cut up his concubine, he knew what he had to do, and he knew that shock value would be the only thing to motivate these people to come together as one man to deal with this evil. But the fact that that things had degenerated to that point where he had to do that, I think says a lot, because God judged the whole nation because of it. Anybody want to have anything I want to add or share?
No.